Hello. For this episode of Airs for Architecture, I spoke with Katie Lloyd-Thomas, Professor of Architectural History and Theory at Newcastle University, about her book Building Materials, Material Theory and the Architectural Specification, published by Bloomsbury in 2021, and the forthcoming conference, Production Studies 2024, Transforming Knowledges of Architecture, Design and Labour, taking place at Newcastle University on the 25th to the 28th of March.
Airs for Architecture, a podcast about architecture, buildings, urban culture and space.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Airs for Architecture. I'm speaking today to Professor Katie Lloyd-Thomas about her recent book, her 2022 book, Building Materials, Material Theory and the Architectural Specification, published by Bloomsbury. But before we get into the book, Katie, perhaps you'd be so kind as to introduce yourself.
Hello, yes. So I'm Katie Lloyd-Thomas and I teach at Newcastle University. I did train as an architect, but I never finished my part three. So I probably worked as an architect intermittently up until I was about 30 and then started to get into academia and in teaching and research. And I did a PhD quite late in my 30s. And the book Building Materials actually comes out of some of the research for that PhD. It took me a long time to write it and get it published.
But where did you study architecture to begin with?
I did my undergraduate degree at Cambridge. I took 3 years out, which was quite unusual in between.
In practice,
I went and volunteered with an NGO in Thailand who are working with slum dwellers who are facing eviction, actually. And then I went back to University of East London. I was really keen to go somewhere where, in fact, where making was high on the agenda more than talking about architecture, which was something that happened a lot at Cambridge at the time. I had a really good 2 years at University of East London. And then I did a master's at Nottingham. It was called the Masters in Architecture and Critical Theory, which Neil Leach ran for some years. And that was really transformational, I think, for me, a turning point.
What does architectural and critical theory look like?
I suppose what Neil Leach was interested in doing was working with people trained in architecture or interested in architecture and looking at some of the key texts that had come out at that time, often that would directly talk about architecture or space. So we would look at, Michel Foucault, at Derrida, at Deleuze, at some of the sort of feminist and psychoanalytic thinkers at the time, people like Julia Kristeva or Hélène Sisson. So we were almost looking at sort of a critical theory writer each week or philosopher and thinking about what their ideas had to do with architecture.
And that kind of pushed you towards, away from, I suppose, the building towards the text, which is kind of partly what building materials is about.
Yeah, that's right, because building materials both looks at the work of a philosopher, at Gilbert Simondon's work, and also at the architectural specification, which is a textual document. That's probably the best way to define it. The drawing is a drawing and the specification describes a building in words. And yeah, I think that's right. The PhD, it took me some time to do a PhD after the master's. And actually, when I started the research, the question that was really on my mind was probably a more abstract question than comes up in the book. And that was a question about materiality. I had got really interested in the idea that materials might in some way be political, that we thought a lot about how, discourse expressed sort of political ideas or could be politically persuasive. But I was interested in the idea that materiality might be, and I mean materiality in a really wide sort of way. So, you know, when you go to a political protest, it's not just what is said that sort of inspires you politically or produces change, but something about the kind of the voice of the you know, in which things are said, or the materiality, or the sort of the materiality in the of the bodies that are around you. And so I had this kind of this was the kind of question in my mind that I started with. And in fact, I did quite a lot of reading. I was mostly looking at fine art and at poetry at the beginning of my PhD research. And what I got really interested in was how language describes materials and the materiality of language. So not just spoken language, but literally, you know, a letter on a page has a kind of fleshy quality, literally an inky quality. And what was the relationship then between almost the meaning and the kind of materiality of language? And then literally, I just started to remember something from the days when I had been working as a jobbing sort of architect, and I'd written specifications. And that was that we had different ways when we wrote a specification of describing materials. So on the one hand, we might just name a material. We must, you know, just say the kind of wood we wanted or the kind of brick. On the other, we might describe, you know, how to mix a concrete or the recipe for a concrete in the specification. This happens less now than it did in the days I was sort of handwriting specifications for a small practice. And then also the performance specification, which is maybe the most interesting form of specification, which describes a material through what it does, so how it's going to act, how much light a material should let through, how much sound, and so on. And it really was like a hunch at the time that this was something interesting in this. In a way, there was a correspondence. This is what fascinated me at first, a correspondence between the material and the way it was written about. That was what I thought at first, anyway. And so my PhD research took a very different direction. And I wanted to find out if this idea about specifications was in any way true. I knew that, you know, they were an incredible resource for finding writing about materials that comes out of architectural practice. But I didn't know if this kind of hunch about the different forms of description would bear out. And I certainly didn't know what that might look like historically, you know, if I moved away from the ones that I'd been writing in my architect's office in Clapham in the 2000s, you know, to start looking more widely. And in fact, there was almost no there was no historical work on specifications. There was very little to help me. I just had to start finding documents and reading them myself, I guess. In general, they're not much collected. Archives like drawings, they don't like all the kind of bureaucratic administrative stuff. Mostly I use the RIBA archives, and I would, you know, try and get specifications from architects, which sometimes proved actually very difficult to do.
Because they don't keep them, or because they constitute some form of slightly protected legal thing, or
absolutely the latter. I mean, I think they do keep them because they're so important legally. So, you know, you could easily, you know, be sued for having, you know, put the wrong thing in a specification, or similarly, you know, if it turned out that a defect had been caused by some, you know, the contractor not following the specification. Mm-hmm. So they're really important to keep. But that's absolutely right. Because of that anxiety, because of sort of anxiety around libel largely, especially the bigger architects didn't want to give me access to their specifications.
I imagine that. I mean, post Grenfell, and this is slightly oblique to the general trajectory of the conversation But post Grenfell, the specification must have been explored a huge amount during the investigation into that disaster, because it was a specifying problem.
That's right, and it's a really good point. And quite often, I mean, pre Grenfell, talking about the specification and how important it was, how important the specification of materials was, how much it mattered who did that specifying. And I mean, the specification now is written in such a way often that architects don't select materials, in fact must not select materials, either to reduce their liability or just to give the contractor much more freedom to do things the sort of cheapest way. All of those things, I think, were quite difficult for people to see and understand, especially if they were outside the kind of industry pre-Grenfell. But post-Grenfell, it became really obvious that I suppose that these sorts of questions really, really mattered. So it was a big change in the kind of reception of my research too, and the kinds of conversations that, you know, that I would have if I would talk about it. People could suddenly see the urgency, I think.
Yeah. I mean, that sort of makes sense about the kind of the moment that this book sits within. It's sort of super timely in that respect, because we are, and we'll talk about this, I think, a little bit later, but we're entering a phase in which materials have a much more heightened political agency than perhaps they have before. But perhaps, I sort of want to kind of set the ground plane for this discussion. You've talked about, you know, your background within critical theory and this idea, in a way, I suppose, of the specification as a form of literature. And you mention also, I think, that the specification actually is the more abundant instrument of architectural production than the drawing. But the drawing is what we like to be judged on as architects. But perhaps we can come to this idea of the what's called the material turn. I think you referenced the material turn in theory. And I wondered whether you might sort of position that and the work in relation to this material turn. What is the material turn, I suppose?
Yeah, I think I perfectly embody the material turn. So I guess it was, I suppose, at least if we think about it from the perspective of architecture, there was a period in the 80s and 90s, perhaps even going back to the 70s, where people were really interested in questions around meaning and signification and the kind of the language of architecture. And in a way, you almost read architecture as a kind of a series of signs, a sort of, you know, as a discourse. And this, you know, comes out of the structuralism of the 60s and 70s. So, and I think, and then what you get, at least in architectural discourse, is interesting to think about it across other disciplines as well, is a much more interest in the building as a thing, as a material object, and a kind of turn away from this sort of a discursive approach to buildings. But I have to say that that didn't mean immediately that people were actually very interested in materials as kind of as commodities. I mean, they were interested, there was an interest in the body and how, you know, how materials might be experienced. There was also, really importantly, the interest, you know, the questions around the environment and sustainability. So that's really, I think, fed the material turn, and been really important as well in terms of starting to think about extraction and the whole life cycle of materials. So that, I think that changed, you know, changed our way of thinking tending to focus on materials as, you know, part of a static structure, to starting to see that they had a complex life where they went through many, you know, many different mutations and forms.
But it's this thing that you kind of, again, you intimate at the beginning, which is around the idea of architecture being more than just the building, and in fact, more than just the site, but this material turn and the way that, in your case, the specification indicates a a host of kind of connected enterprises, agencies, processes, which also are significant in the production of buildings.
Yeah, I think that's really, that's exactly right. So I think if you look at a drawing of a building, you can almost forget all of those, you know, all of those factors. I mean, of course, and the materials, I mean, there might be notes on a drawing saying something about the materials. They're almost disappeared as well in a drawing. But if you look at the specification, and initially, I mean, I looked at the specification, like I said, I was just interested in these descriptions and, you know, and I really just wanted to find descriptions of materials. You can't help but see the real processes through which buildings come, you know, come into existence. So, you know, the surveyors, the you know, if we go back in time, the carpenters, the accountants, you know, the inspectors, all the kind of that will be true in older specifications. Today we'll see different things in a performance specification. We'll see a very sort of abstracted language, which also reveals to us, we can only understand why that language is the way it is by starting to think about how the building industry is organized. So there is something where all of that kind of the pragmatic world in which buildings emerge becomes very visible, impossible not to see. And these descriptions that I was interested in aren't descriptions which you sort of just choose. You know, I think today I'm going to describe a material by how it's mixed up on site. But, you know, tomorrow I think I'm going to just name it. They're not really choices. They're things which emerge again because the building industry is organized in a particular way. So I had no intention, actually, when I did the research, I had no intention to engage with all of this. I was probably quite resistant at the beginning, but there was no way of explaining what I was looking at without starting to understand the building industry. So it was really interesting that you could look at drawings and never engage, but you just couldn't do the same with the specification.
So there's this idea. I mean, maybe it would be worth thinking about how to kind of explain the unpacking of the book, because you've talked already about these kinds of three types of specifications. This timeline of specification changes from a kind of purely descriptive, and then through to a kind of process of their production and use on site to this performance thing. Perhaps a kind of idea of that chronology would be useful.
Okay, that's quite a big, that is a big question. And one of the things is that very often all of these types will coexist, could coexist in the specification. And so, although there is a degree of timeline to it, they also, all the types you can find in old specifications and you know, in newer ones. And I think it's also important to say that because the timeline and the changes relate to the organization of the building industry, it's very dependent on where in the world you're looking at a specification, because building cultures and building industries develop and change in really radically different ways around the world. So those are some caveats. in a very simple way, so the most sort of simple way of naming, of describing a material in the specification. And you see this, just in a kind of almost like a accountant sort of list of materials when they're trying to price a building in advance of it happening, is just to name, to name the material. So, you know, is it going to be oak? Is it going to be beech? Is it going to be pine? Those very sort of simple ways of of not even describing materials, just literally you're naming them. And in the book, I do use timbers as a way to explore naming materials. And even that changes in interesting ways as well through time. And so that, I suppose that, you know, that's the dominant way, and that's, you know, perhaps, you know, or this, the oldest way. And then one of the most interesting, rich and lovely to read for sure, form of description is the process-based, what I call the process-based clause. So that's, yeah, say when you get, it will probably be a number of clauses explaining exactly how you're going to make up some concrete on site. You've got to just you describe it like a recipe. It's you have to give the ingredients, but also what's going to be done on site. So you're thinking of material as something which is made. And in Britain, at least, that starts to emerge in specifications in the late 18th century. And it really is a very dominant form of clause. Not for all materials. Some of them don't, go very well with a process-based description, but it's very, very dominant really right up until the sort of 60s and 70s in the 20th century. So a very long span. And it turns out that that's really related to the sort of moment of the building industry becoming a capitalist building industry, a sort of full-blown capitalist industry. It's probably this complicated to explain.
What do you mean by capitalist? Do you mean like a set within a kind of global economy, or do you mean something that is entirely profit orientated, or do you mean that's the question that's immediately coming to mind, like what kind of builders were descriptive and very precise specifications being given to?
So let's say we're in the middle of the 18th century.
As I often do.
And we're building a nice townhouse in the centre of London, a grand townhouse in the centre of London. So one of the specifications I talk about in the book at length is it doing exactly that. And all of that does, it's a bit like it just describes the lowest floor first, and it tells you what beams you're going to need, how long they're going to be, and what wood they're going to be, what would you need, you know, so is it oak or beech or whatever. And it just progresses, it's a single sheet, and it just progresses describing each floor up to the top of the building. And then it does the sort of servants' quarters and the outhouses. And it gives us very, very limited information about the materials. And so that's very much in this kind of naming register. And this contract would have just been, it would have been organised by a master carpenter. They would have probably supplied the materials themselves as well. And I mean, it's a legal document. No one's going to read it, you know, for instruction. It's really a legal document to make sure that, you know, the client is going to get what they expect. And, you know, the contractor knows what they're going to be paid and the extent of the work. So you have that, and that's being managed effectively by a builder, perhaps with just a small team of workers. And the building is also, it's a, really a known kind, you know, it's the same as the one of his neighbours' houses and so on. So there's a lot of trust involved as well. And quite possibly no accompanying drawings, don't know in this case. But a few years later, you start to get much bigger projects which are run by general contractors. So you now have effectively somebody a bit like the kind of like the factory owner, a capitalist who is seeking to make money by organizing other people to do building work for them. And at that point, the specification becomes an incredibly important tool in the process of organizing building work. And also ensuring if you're going to make money as a general contractor, you have to be sure that the bricklayers will do a decent job, but they won't charge you so much that you can't anymore make any profit. So the specification starts to be really, really detailed, it almost acting like a kind of instrument to ensure the quality of the work and to allow the general contractor to still make profit. So you see at this point, you suddenly see specifications which are now organized not floor by floor, but trade by trade. So you'll have a bricklayer's specification, a plumber's specification, a painter's specification, and so on. And within those is the beginnings of these process-based clauses. So these much more detailed accounts of how the work is to be done, which are really there to sort of ensure quality. There's also a change in the way, actually it's a detail, it doesn't really matter. There's a change in the way that contractors charge for their work as well, but that's another detail.
But it's so, really interesting. It's a really interesting idea, and I'm listening to this. You talk about contractors, talking about specifications, and not talking about architects. And I think that's a really fascinating idea that in this process, the architect almost seems absent from the critical part of their production. It's like they're not in, I don't know, are they involved? I mean, what is their role in this? Obviously they write the spec and well, to a certain degree, they write the spec, but I imagine it changes building type. So if you're building a long terrace of Georgian townhouses or a long terrace of Victorian townhouses, the architect probably has very minimal impact actually. So they write the specification, they hand it over and kind of, as you say, the houses are just kind of rolled out. They look like what houses look like. They're produced in the way that houses are produced. The builders are in a way trusted, or the contractor is trusted to replicate it.
Yes.
Is that right?
I think that is right. And I think then when you get to the change and there isn't trust anymore, because you get to this kind of general contractor change. The discourse of the time is all about these kind of, you know, wayward, untrustworthy general contractors. It's fascinating. Mm. And then how do you produce enough information to secure the quality of the building? So what you do sort of start to understand the architect as is perhaps less as a designer and more as a producer of information. Mm. And you start to think, well, and of course, I mean, well, certainly when I was working in this little practice, we spent a lot of time writing specifications, but you know, you never hear about that, in uni, you never hear about that in books. Sometimes we've called it, along with someone I sometimes write with, Thilo Amhoff, who also has done some research on the specification, we've called it the writing work of architects. We always think about the kind of drawing and designing work. So I think, yeah, it's this enormous sea change in the production of information. And you do, in the process-based specification, it's delightful because, you know, every sort of, you know, everything that's going to happen on site gets recorded, you know, buckets being washed out, you know, the inspections that need to be carried out. So you do also see the architect constantly sort of in there. Sometimes it's a surveyor, a slightly different role, but you see the architect in there kind of checking this work that they've described in the documentation beforehand. And I suppose that production of information has only escalated.
Coming back to this idea of the capitalist thing, this idea of, I mean, we're talking about a slow process of modernization, really, aren't we? And in the sense, not only of technological advance, and informational advance, but also in the sense of the alienation of the various kind of disciplines within the building trade. Like, as you say, you start writing specs that are just for the joiners and writing specs that are just for the glazers and for the M&E, you know, it's like for the electricians and so on and so forth. And the kind of idea of a building as a kind of a holistic entity produced holistically starts to fall apart quite quickly.
Yeah, that's right. It's not something I talk about very much in the book. But more recently, I've been working on a project with Brazilian scholars and architects. And we've been translating the work of a Brazilian architectural historian and theorist called Sergio Ferro. And he has some really hard-hitting things to say about the role of the architect and the role of the drawing, indeed, in this transformation of building into a full-blown capitalist endeavor. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we're still not making buildings, you know, in a factory where you can kind of control production processes and ensure productivity. So Sergio Ferro is asking, he looks very carefully at all of the architect's techniques and makes the case that actually what the techniques are doing, and this is including drawing, are enabling contractors and developers to make enormous money out of the labor of building buildings. And for Ferro, that splitting up of the trades, so building trades who were working on site together, who were making design decisions together, if you think of sort of Gothic cathedrals as the obvious example, design and information and building were all kind of happening together and in the control of the same group of people. Technical knowledge was very closely guarded in the guilds and so on. So builders had a great deal of autonomy. And for Ferro, what he understands, the production of all these forms of information takes away the autonomy of building workers to make those decisions and also, I suppose, to, you know, to keep the financial rewards of their endeavours and sort of redistributes it. So he very much sees, it's a very hard hitting analysis, but he would very much see all those sorts of documents that we and information as gradually sort of taking away people's power to
I mean, this might be a good moment to plug your production studies 2024 Transforming Knowledges and of Architecture, Design and Labor conference next year in March, which does look really, really good, and at which obviously Sergio Ferro is giving the keynote, so and which you're organizing, I assume.
Yes, we're busy organizing that at the moment. Yes, so we hope that this will be a big international conference, starting with some of Sergio Ferro's ideas, but really thinking about these questions about the production of the built environment. Also, you know, hoping to think about kind of more emancipatory ways that people can build, as well as, you know, providing critique, bringing, I suppose, the kind of labor and production of building to the forefront over its design, but always interested in the interrelationship.
I'm really interested in this idea of as architects get squeezed, this reciprocity that you talk about in this kind of first phase of the specification as you were exploring it and analyzing it. There's a kind of implicit reciprocity between the builder and the tradesman, and the architect, the builder, the tradesman, and I'm reminded of a story I read about Brunelleschi when he was building the Duomo in Florence, and would actually go to the quarries and actually draw on the stone the shapes that he needed by hand, which is probably apocryphal, but it's a delightful apocryphal story, which I am determined to believe.
They're renowned for very cleverly smashing a strike by the construction workers. So there's lots of very interesting stories. Yeah. Anyway, go on.
I'm also, so the architect gets kind of squeezed a little bit, but I wonder if you've thought, the specification strikes me as becoming increasingly like a design object in a way, like it starts performing in a designly way in this second phase that you talk about, this the specification that emerges in the late 18th century, where you're starting to get the architect actually detailing what the mortar mixes are supposed to be. And like, I mean, I've worked on specifications like this myself. I think that they're more like when you're doing private residential, you're working with smaller contractors, you're doing kind of very bespoke work. And I suspect, because I was the last architects the two last architects I worked at, one did historical stuff, and that and that form of specification is still very much there, where you're talking, you know, where you're doing a restoration on grade one listed buildings, and you know, the heritage bodies want to know that the mortar is containing the right levels of lime and so on and so forth. Mm-hmm. Or the hammering effect on the granite is going to be. And it does become like a design exercise. Like, you have to think about it in a designerly way. It's like thinking about, well, you've done the drawings and you've dotted in so the bricks look like they're a certain type of brick, and then all of a sudden you have to write it.
Mm-hmm. That's right. There's something really interesting, isn't there, about the language you have to use, the fact that you can have temporality in it as well. So you can think of it as a process, of a sequence, mm-hmm. of what it's not just what the thing is going to be like, but how you would arrive at it.
Mm.
I mean, it's total speculation, but I have a bit of a fantasy that the fact that you get sort of all these architects in the 19th century really interested in the craft of building, then there's Pugin and William Morris and so on. I had this kind of fantasy that it actually comes out of the fact that they were sitting in their offices writing these, very, very rich process clauses where you really are thinking about the fabrication and the making of buildings. So mm-hmm. although on the one hand, what it's doing is alienating, if we sort of take this kind of Ferro's analysis, but it's alienating the workers in many ways and making their lives less satisfactory, I think it sort of produces for architects a closeness or a yearning for the actual kind of or an engagement with the actual making and fabrication of building. Mm. I suppose, I mean, could it, even be like politically transforming, could make you think much more also about the people that really do build stuff.
Yeah, it's interesting. It reminded me, when I was reading the book, it reminded me, and this idea of the detailed specification reminded me, and this sounds gloriously pretentious, so I like it, of Tennessee Williams' stage directions in Cat in a Hot Tin Roof and Streetcar Named Desire, where you get this peculiar thing where he's actually defining exactly how they come onto the stage, what their deportment is, exactly what point. It's like really interesting. Like, it's not the architect in this term of specification is becoming like the artist, and you do mention this idea, this transformation of the architect away from a kind of allied building industry professional to something that is something different. To an artist, they sort of separate themselves. So it's in a way, there's this peculiar thing where both they are being separated from this kind of engagement with the production of the building, but they're also doing it to themselves. They kind of will it upon themselves.
Yeah, so for sure. So there's something really important about the what you're doing when you're drawing, or what you're doing even when you're writing in an office, is giving you a professional status that's very different. I mean, you also get the emergence, don't you, of the professionalization of the of architecture, like in I think it's in the 1830s that the RIBA is established. So this whole, gradually sort of over those centuries, sort of since Gothic sort of Renaissance period where the architect emerges in Europe, you're gradually getting the professionalization of the architect lifting themselves out of the world of building. And I mean, interestingly, the townhouse that I was talking about, the guy who's the so-called architect, there is an architect who writes the specification, if you like. He's, you know, who he's somebody who has been, I forget if it was a carpenter or a mason, I think a carpenter, and like many in the 18th century who sort of call themselves architects, they've come out of being builders originally. And that, of course, changes in the 19th and 20th centuries. It becomes something you go and study at university, and that kind of gulf is much, much wider.
Yeah, yeah. The issue around professional versus lay knowledge seems to permeate the whole discourse, as the whole sort of discourse as well, in the idea of an integrated lay knowledge that is characteristic. And maybe this goes back to some of your experiences in informal settlements, the kind of the way that stuff is produced and knowledge is communicated is very distinct, and professional knowledge is a very distinct form of knowledge. I mean, the architect has credibility because of their professional status, which guarantees, in this case, technical knowledge around how to describe the correct materials for a condition. Do you know what I'm saying? It's like, yes, it's like,
right. And it's taking, I mean, it's in a simple sort of way, it's taking the know-how away. The architect now has the know-how, the right language with which to, it's a very peculiar stilted language, you know, in the specification, a sort of legalese as well, you know, with lots of herebys and, you know, so yeah, on. Yeah. And
weird sort of 17th, 18th century language.
Yeah, that's right. And so, yeah, so there's something definitely happens there. Mm. But coming forward to the present day, I think what's, and if you've written, you know, or even tried to make sense of performance-based specifications. So these, you know, now use, I mean, they describe things in
When does the performance-based specification come in? You're around the 60s and 70s when we're starting to, and what causes it? I think perhaps that's a good position to start with.
Okay, so well, in fact, I mean, in fact, it emerges much earlier, say, in the US than it does in the UK. But yeah, it's sort of being discussed in the 70s. So I suppose there's a desire. I think largely, I mean, there's a sort of scientification there's of the building industry. So that's kind of happening anyway, and the rationalization of building. So on the one hand, and we've got the development of material science, which is what makes performance specification possible. Mm-hmm. But I think what really pushes performance specification is, you know, is two forces. And I'm not sure I've got exactly the answer about why it, you know, why it happens at that particular time or where the forces come from. And it's slow. But there are two things. So one is to avoid litigation. So if I say, you know, in the specification, you know, you've got to use this particular concrete mix. And then, well, we've got a good example of it at the moment with RAC. And I say, you've got to use this, and then it turns out to fail, and I'm the architect that specified it, then it's my responsibility and the liability falls on me. So one So using the performance specification, you don't name the material anymore. What you do instead is say that the material to be used must meet a certain set of criteria. And then that pushes that responsibility away onto, you know, to other places. I mean, interestingly, there are other issues. If you don't name the material in that way, there's also kind of questions around competition. So really interesting as well. If I name a material in the specification, I'm making a sale on behalf of a manufacturer as well. So sometimes naming materials is avoided. I think in specifications in Europe, for example, because of competition law. So it's always open which product or material you use. And then the third reason is it can be really good for contractors. So it means that for a contractor, they can choose the most expedient, or perhaps they've got a deal with a particular manufacturer and they can get a good discount. They can choose the materials that that they work with. So there are kind of lots and lots of reasons for specifying through a material by the criteria it's meant to meet, or how it's got to behave in the building, rather than by naming it.
I'm aware of time. I'm RAC, by the way, for anybody listening outside the British news concept context, is reinforced autoclaved aerated concrete, which was put in buildings from the mid 20th century through to the 90s and is now starting to fail. and God knows what the outcome of all of this will be, but there's a lot of buildings involved in it. Your book deals with, as you mentioned at the beginning, Gilbert Simondon. And not deals with it, it structures itself around his approach to materials, to stuff. Perhaps it would be good, I suppose, to understand this, because the theorists that architects in general, particularly in education, tend to circulate around are a small number, and he ain't one of them. But maybe he should be.
Well, he should be, and I think there are more people reading Simondon now, and very happily. When I started getting very interested in Simondon, his work hadn't been translated into English from the original French, and it now is. So that makes it much more accessible to anyone who's interested to find out more about him. Interestingly, the people that were reading, the architects that were reading Simondon when I was in the early days of this research, were in French-speaking Canada, which is quite interesting. So there was a little bit of kind of following there, and there was some really interesting early stuff on bricks and concrete that was coming out of their interests. I mean, Simondon's kind of known for two things, and one makes him obvious as a philosopher that might be of interest to architects, which is that he was a kind of philosopher of technology, and he had some really interesting ways of looking at, let's say, the evolution of technical objects, but also he wanted to make a very strong case that we think about aesthetic culture, but we don't think enough and value enough technical culture, and that's really compelling in his work. So he's got a big book, which is The Mode of Existence of Technical Objects, which is probably the first one you'd go to if you were going to read Simondon. And that finishes with an example that was incredibly important to me, this example about a lump of wet clay being moulded in a brick mould. And then there's a much, another big body of work, which is about individuation. And that, to put it simply, is about how things come into being. And Again, really, I suppose, if I'm to ask myself why was Simondon so important for my interests, it's because for Simondon, it was really important not just to look at kind of things as static and as structures, but to always ask about how things come into being, what about processes. And so he tries to develop a philosophy around process. And you can see that if you're interested in the production of things or the life cycle of things, then his way of thinking and approaching the world is incredibly rich and interesting.
And how do you leverage this with regards to this this study of specifications? How is this then used? How do you use it? Ha ha.
Yeah. In 5 minutes. Well, I'll start just by saying, so in the first I'm just thinking, okay, well, let's start with the brick mold. And
which is a beautiful, you know, it's a really beautiful motif. So I'd like would like to think about that.
Okay, so let's think about somebody you know, pushing some wet clay into a brick mold. They take the brick mold. This is long, you know, we're not even thinking about firing the brick at this point. And out comes a perfectly rectangular, brick-shaped piece of clay. And what Simondon thinks is this is a perfect sort of example of something with a very long historical, an idea with a very, very long kind of historical tradition. And that's the idea that form shapes matter, or that in any object there's form and there's matter. And this is an idea that is so beloved of architects, and you can even see it with the kind of split between the drawing and the specification, that you know, you've got the drawing describes the form, and then that, you know, we'll leave describing the sort of matter part to the specification. But what that leaves us with is this sort of very, well, two things: a very sort of static idea about objects, that they're sort of split into this form and matter. But also what Simondon wants to show as a false idea is that almost form imprints itself on matter. And what he then goes on to show through this really long, extended, beautiful example, which reminded me a lot of concrete specifications, in fact, is that what's actually happening inside the brick mold is something very different. The clay has been kneaded. It's got a particular kind of molecular structure, and it's been kneaded, and all of this energy has been pushed through the kneading into the clay. So it's like full of this kind of potential energy, and it's sort of expanding. And when you put the mold on it, you just limit the expanding process. So that makes us think of it much more as both as a sort of a process and of something which is happening between the brick and the mold, if you like. And so in a sense, he needs to do that to show us that the form matter thing doesn't, you know, is a misunderstanding of what's happening. And that allows him then to think in this much more sort of processual, relational way about things in the world. And so in that way, I think it is really, really interesting for architects as a sort of means to allow kind of these long processes, if you like, into the way that we understand the built environment, I guess, or what we're doing.
I think this is a really fascinating idea, and I had to do a tiny presentation to the incoming students this Freshers Week, or Welcome Week, as we now call it. It's not as exciting sounding, is it?
not as drunk sounding, no.
Yeah, perhaps that's a good thing. And I was thinking about a big piece of cast concrete, and having been reading your book, I started thinking about the performance. It's a tidal pool on the coast at Margate, and it's a, you know, 1.5-2 meters wide, and it's just flat, and it encompasses about 4 hectares of water, and it's lovely and it's transformative. And I was starting to think about, in a weird kind of way, and you'll have to correct me if I'm wrong, but there's an implication in what Simondon is saying that grants considerable agency to materials themselves, that the architecture, that the materials used in architecture are, in a way, in some way, I'm not sure, sort of co-authors of the nature and character of the building. And that, I suppose, that's perhaps off-piste in terms of your book around the specification, but perhaps it's not, in that, insofar as when we get to this performance, this performance-based specification, we're starting to see a move away from an instrumentalizing of materials towards something that is kind of like, and allowing the materials to have their agency in this process. Is that, does that make sense? Am I barking up the wrong tree here?
I think you're absolutely right. That it's really important that, yeah, the material isn't passive. It's not merely what would you call it? I don't know, just a kind of, you know, a background or a sort mm-hmm. of substrate for, you know, for something else.
For having form applied to it.
Yeah. And I mean, I think for a lot, there are a number of architects that have been very interested. I mean, more and more so, and especially now that, you know, people are making kind of living materials and experimenting in all kinds of ways now with using bacteria in concrete and all kinds of interesting things like that. So I think that idea that materials have agency, even a kind of intelligence, a capacity for self-organization, all of those mm-hmm. things, I think they're very rich, and they're certainly are given a kind of though Simondon is helpful for those ideas too. I think what's really interesting for me, so I mean, somebody said to me that what I do with Simondon's work is he writes about technical objects. So he writes about living things too, and, you know, human beings and cellular organisms. But the bit that I'm most interested in is when he's talking about technical objects. And somebody once said to me that what I do is I think about the material as about materials as technical objects. So yes, so let's say like any other sort of technical thing that we make. So they're not just the kind of raw material for something else, but they're something which, if you like, and increasingly that we design or we produce for particular for you know, to be used in particular ways. And so that means that they have agency, but they're also kind of invested with all sorts of, forces and ideas themselves, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
I suppose it's not just that they're kind of, you know, they've got some kind of, you know, inert capacities, but also that we've in some way kind of engineered them. We've made them. Like, say, in the case of the clay and the brick mold, that clay has been processed and refined in such a way that it can be shaped by the mold. So it's already kind of got all sorts of expectations in it about how it'll be used, what it can do, and so mm-hmm. on. So I think that those are some of being really attentive about what those expectations are, what those processes are that shape materials. I think it's being attentive to that is the key.
And is that so we're in this phase of the performance specification, as you call it, like you know, where you have to write down it's got to be C24 softwood timber, and that's all you put down, and that means it has to come from Finland or Norway, because that's where that grows, or probably Canada, because probably everything grows in Canada. But we're moving away. So this idea of the performance specification, sort of abstracting architects from the process and allowing us to be, as designers, to act without, in a way, due reverence for the character of the materials and the means of their production and the consequences that come from that, so we can do things. And you talked in your notes, that your wonderful notes that you sent to me, about glazing, performance engineered glazing, for example, which then which is obviously a unit of globalized production. So I guess I'm kind of get trying myself to get my head around this whole idea, because as I said, it's sort of been completely outside my ken in terms of how I've thought about materials before. So the performance specification is what we do. It abstracts us from the processes of the materials themselves, and this is problematic. Question: is this problematic? And if it is problematic, what can we take from your particular book, and how might it modify our practices?
Okay. So, just to think about the performance specification, and I choose performance engineered glass as a nice case to look at it through. So if performance engineered glass is, you know, literally made up of layers that do, you know, at the microscale, that do different things. So one might stop solar gain, you know, another might have a sort of an acoustic layer, another might make the glass strong so that, you know, if a dart comes and punctures it, it will, you know, fracture in a, you know, won't fracture or will fracture or whatever. So it's very, very carefully engineered for these very specific different performances. So you know, I can choose, you know, if I need to have soundproof glass, then I can choose exactly to what extent I need it, depending on what is going to happen in the room that I'm specifying my glass for. So those two things, how you specify the glass, if you like, how you're able to specify it, go hand in hand with the fact that this type of glass exists. I mean, I suppose. And that means that as a specifier, I don't even have to necessarily say that what I'm specifying is glass. I just need to say, look, I want this kind of transparent barrier between my two rooms. In fact, in many situations, as we've said, I mustn't actually say what material I want. So I don't say, you know, who the manufacturer of the glass, or, you know, it could be that it's a plastic that will do exactly the same job. So you're not effectively really specifying the material, you're specifying how it's going to, you know, the things it must do for the particular environment you're talking about.
And that includes sort of aesthetic things as well, doesn't it? You know, as an architect, you might say I need it to be. There's a couple of examples I can think of where in a famous London, gigantic London art gallery, the original specification for a handrail in it, which the architect chucked down, would have used the entire global supply of that particular wood because it was it was a hard one. So instead they used pine and painted it the right color.
I see. Okay.
Or, you know, some other hardwood and painted it.
Somewhere in the book I write about it because it's so fascinating. So in these, in the sort of most extreme versions of the performance specification, they have this fantastic phrase called visual intent, where what you can do is describe the visual intent of whatever material it is you're going to use. So that's kind of, exactly that, you know, at least could it be the right color if it... so I suppose what that, I mean, very literally, that means as an architect, you don't have control over what the material is going to be. So, there are a whole range of problems that come out of that. You know, I suppose if you want to make sure that it hasn't used certain chemicals or it hasn't used some kind of labor that you don't approve of, I suppose you could maybe make that part of the specification too. But effectively, you're just not in control of those decisions.
Yeah. And that's advantaged, as you pointed out, you know, this goes back to this idea of the organization of the building industry. That has been to the great advantage of this highly profit-driven model, where if you can extract the kind of designerly and ethical imperative that actually is part of the professional architect's social obligation as a profession to do good, to make beautiful things. If you can extract that out and get them to specify in this generic way as a kind of Uber builder, Uber contractor, you can subvert that process. And who the hell cares who's making it and where it's being, and you know, that rainforest has been cut down or orangutans been shot or whatever it is, or that trillions of tons of bauxite are having to be mined to make your windows.
That's right, and the sort of vice versa of that is that if there's an obligation for all the kind of legal reasons we've talked about, or because because the contractor is insisting on a design and build contract, if there's an obligation, if you must use performance specification, there are also a whole range of materials you can't use because of the requirement. To performance specify something, you have to be able to test it in particular ways that you can evidence that the samples of all samples of this material will behave in a certain way.
Mm-hmm.
It also mitigates against a whole range of materials as well. So it's sort of great for huge global producers of materials, and poor for kind of experimental materials that you might want to give a go on a small site. So and in that way it's really insidious, I suppose. It really plants kind of material use as being something about big business. But you did ask about, well, what can you do about it? And in the most simple way, I mean, this is, it's a favorite phrase, and it's the title of the last chapter of the book. It's what Simon Dunn asks us to do. He says you have to go into the mold. So, you know, if you want to understand what's going on with that clay brick, you can't just keep making the clay bricks. You have to sort of try and understand what's happening. And I think that in that way, we just need to not, need to try and understand the sort of, in a way, what's hidden behind these simple, normally we just make nowadays you'll just prepare a specification using software, and you'll just probably make a series of decisions. Mostly the software is making them for you, or you might farm it out to a specifier. I suppose the thing is just to try and make, you know, to try and understand what those processes are, where you might want to intervene, how you can do things differently. I mean, you know, the performance specification is so beautiful. I have like an example of a performance specification in the book from a 19th century spec. And it's that this floor should be made out of timber such that it will be traversed for dancing. And it's just so beautiful. I mean, the idea that, you know, that you specify something for what how it's going to be used is really beautiful, potentially. It's only the way that it's kind of, you know, situated in the kind of big business of the building industry that's its problem. So I sort of think as well that, you know, if you start to think about these different ways of giving information, different ways of describing your buildings, there's also like all sorts of room for, you know, invention and creativity as well. So, but I think it's just not or this other term, you know, to go inside the black box. Don't think, well, that's just technical. It's not, you know, it's not interesting. I don't need to know about it. It's being decided somewhere else. It's, I suppose, really the opportunity to engage with those sorts of questions.
Fantastic. Thank you. That's a wonderful point to stop on.
All right.
Mies said architecture starts when you carefully put two bricks together, but he was wrong, and Katie's right. Starts well before then. Thanks to her for the conversation and to Bloomsbury for the book. It's a lovely addition. Links to it and to Katie's professional and social profiles are in the podcast description, as is a link to the Production Studies conference website. There's still time to book a place. Thanks for listening.